That was saxophonist Peter Breutzmann playing a solo version of I Surrender, Dear, the old jazz standard. It's the title track of an album he released last year, all solo tenor sax and mostly classic jazz tunes. It includes versions of Lover Come Back to Me, Con Alma, Nice Work If You Can Get It, Lady Sings the Blues, an old Sonny Rollins piece called Sumphin, S-U-M-P-H-I-N, and a bunch of other stuff. It's a really fantastic record, not only because the music is beautiful, but because it shows a completely different side of Breutzmann than most people are familiar with. And Peter Breutzmann is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance Podcast. If you're listening to this, thank you, and welcome back. We've been on hiatus since October, and I should say right up front that my plans for 2020 are to only do one episode a month. That might change down the road, but that's the way things are looking right now. In any case, the Burning Ambulance Podcast remains part of the Osiris Network, so visit osirispod.com because they have a ton of other great shows, the vast majority of which are music-related, so there's plenty of other stuff to listen to. But let's get started with this episode. Peter Breutzmann first emerged onto the global scene in the late 60s. He released his first album, For Adolf Sax, named for the inventor of the saxophone, in 1967. A year later, he made Machine Gun, which is a landmark record not just in free jazz, but in jazz history, period. It featured an 8-piece band that included Evan Parker and Willem Breuker on tenor saxes, Fred Van Hove on piano, Bushi Niebergall and Peter Kowald on bass, and Han Bennick and Sven Oak Johansson on drums. A lot of critics said that the music was more extreme than anything that had come before, mostly because Breutzmann and the other two saxophonists seemed to be going really far out on their horns, even farther than John Coltrane or Pharoah Sanders or Albert Eiler had gone. But when you pay close attention to it, you'll hear that there are actually riffs, really big, honking, fist-pumping riffs, especially at the end. And Breutzman has said many times that the music was inspired by Lionel Hampton's big band, which had four saxophonists up front blowing in unison. I've been a fan of Breutzman's for a long time. I've seen him live twice. The first time was in January 1997 at the Cooler in the Meatpacking District in Manhattan. He played with Thomas Borgman on saxophone, William Parker on bass, and Rashid Bakar on drums. The show was actually recorded and released on CD under the name The Cooler Suite. The other time was a couple of years later at Tonic with a version of his quartet Die Like a Dog. On record, that band usually featured Toshinori Kondo on trumpet, William Parker on bass, and Hamid Drake on drums. But at this gig, Kondo wasn't there for whatever reason, and Roy Campbell subbed in. I was also a big fan of Last Exit, a group formed by Bill Laswell that included Breutzman, Sonny Chirac on guitar, and Ronald Shannon Jackson on drums. Their music was a combination of free jazz, metal, and funk, totally improvised in the moment, and some of it is amazing. It used to be hard to find their CDs, but now you can get almost all of their albums on Bill Laswell's Bandcamp page. So look them up if you're not already familiar with their work. One of the things that I find really fascinating about Breutzman is that he seems to do mostly one thing no matter what the context. Like, he sounds pretty much the same with Last Exit as he does with his band Full Blast, or with Mats Gustafsson and Paul Nilsson Love, or with steel guitarist Heather Lee, or with the Portuguese rock band Black Bombay. But if you pay attention, instead of just letting it, like, wash over you, you can tell that he's actually listening really carefully to what his collaborators are doing and figuring out how what he does will best mesh with that. It goes back to something I talked about with Branford Marsalis when he was on the podcast. He said that Ornette Coleman and David Murray, who had performed with the Grateful Dead, hadn't really interacted with them in any depth. They'd just done their thing with the Dead in the background. Whereas he had taken the time to figure out how the Dead's music actually worked and where he could fit into their existing frameworks. Now, I've never listened to any of the Dead shows with any of those guys, so I'm not in a position to argue one way or the other. And I do know that Murray later recorded an entire album of Dead music, so I'm guessing there was some kind of connection for him. But the broader point is a valid one. And I feel like Breutzman is much more the second type of improviser, even if he has a reputation as the first type. He does his thing, but he does it in a way that works with and for his collaborators. He's actually a very generous musician in that respect. This interview was recorded back in early October, and a lot of it's about the album I Surrender, Dear, and a lot of it's about Breutzman's connections to jazz history. He really loves old-school players like Don Byas and Coleman Hawkins and people like that, and he absolutely loves the blues, so we talk a lot about that. I think you'll really get a sense of him as a music fan. He talks about all the bands he saw growing up in Germany in the 50s and 60s. We talk about what he looks for in collaborations and how he chooses projects, too, because he gets more invitations than he accepts. We also talk about his visual art, which is just as important as the music. He had originally planned to be a visual artist with music as a side thing, but it didn't work out that way, obviously. Still, he's designed almost all of his own album covers for the last 50 years, and he's got an instantly recognizable visual style, very blocky and heavy like a printmaker. It's a perfect complement to his sound on the horn, really. And then at the very end of our conversation, I ask him about Ginger Baker, the drummer. Baker had died just a few days before we spoke, and the two of them had played together for three gigs in 1987 in a band that included Sonny Chirac and Nicky Skopelidis on guitars and Jan Kazda on bass, so it was kind of a cross between Last Exit and Baker's band African Force, which Kazda played in. Two of the three shows that they played were recorded, and the music was released under the name No Material. So that's where this conversation ends, with Breutzman's memories of Ginger Baker, but everything leading up to that is just as fascinating. So I hope you enjoy this interview, and thanks for listening. Mr. Breutzman?
Yes?
How are you, sir?
Not too bad, not too bad. Thank you.
Yeah.
So, when did the idea for this album come to you, and when did you record it and stuff like that?
I mean, the idea doing this kind of thing is quite an old idea, but it took some years to come to the right point to do it. And so I had the chance to go to the studio in Vienna for a couple of days. And it's a kind of thing which was always over the years in my mind, because it's all the tunes, or some of the tunes. If I'm playing at home, for example, I usually play standards and things like that. And just to practice and to get the sound right, and it's a good exercise to do that. And I mean, I come out of that times, and Coleman Hawkins still is my favorite. So it's also the right time to try a little tribute to all the great guys of the past.
It's
And
very
another,
clean. Had you worked with that engineer, Martin Sievert, before?
oh yes, I know Martin, and I know he is one of the best in Europe. So it's always a pleasure to work with him, and he knows what I want, and it's really a perfect team.
On some of your other solo records, you've played a lot of different horns, and there's one where you even played two clarinets at once, but this time you decided to just play tenor. Why did you,
Yeah, I mean, we spent 3 days together in the studio, and when we finished, I had about 7 hours of music in the box. So I had to make a kind of decision and a kind of selection. So for this time, I just decided I stick with the tenor. And anyway, the tenor is my main thing, and over the years, it's my travel instrument, and the one it's very close to me.
Playing solo seems to bring out the more romantic and melodic side of you. Why do you think that is?
Has for sure a lot of reasons, and one for sure is getting a little older. But you know, these songs are always on my side through the time I played in the Dixieland band. And when I'm walking around, or when I'm in a new city and walk strolling through the streets, I'm always whistling, and it comes always to some of these old songs. So it was a kind of logical thing to try that. And one thing is, even when I do my wildest shit and the so-called avant-garde nonsense, I wanted to show, especially the young folks, that it has a relation to the tradition and to the history. I mean, in Europe, it's quite easy sometimes to forget where the music comes from. And it's American music, and the sources and the roots are in American entertainment industry, and that was one of the points I wanted to make clear.
Yeah, it's funny because some of the people that you've played with over the years seem to kind of consciously reject that, particularly Derek Bailey, who I remember told me once that for him, jazz died in 1953.
Yeah, that might be out of his point of view, that might be right. But, you know, I think it was his last recordings. He came back to some of the old songs out of the times where he was playing some kind of standards in the local bars. So I think he, as far as we move away from the old traditional material, but we all, at least my age, we all are connected to that. I mean, I still work from time to time with my old comrade, Han Benning, and he started with swing and bebop music, and he still has that in his playing. And that's the thing we just have somehow. I mean, I'm far away to say that I play it in an American way of their players that can do the shit much better. I just use all what I've learned. I use it in my own way, and my European view of the things and of the music for sure is a different one from some of my American colleagues, but that's what I can do.
Yeah. It's interesting. It seems to me that a lot of your albums with other musicians are documents. They're improvisations that were recorded, but the solo albums feel more like statements. Do they mean more to you from an artistic point of view when it's, you know, because they're dedicated to people and stuff like that?
You know, if you are alone and you just have the mic in front of you, you automatically think different about the music. I mean, when you are on stage, you have at least one other guy, and of course music, especially jazz music, is made to do it with a handful of guys and try to get together. But the solo situation is different. And you're right. I mean, I think if you look back to my earlier solo records, they are more a kind of statement than of course, a kind of live recording with other musicians. And for sure, this one is a special statement, and because I really wanted to show my connections to the roots of music too. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of blues elements in it, and I mean the music without the blues is not existing. And that is nowadays quite a bit for granted. I mean, I was lucky in my young life to have the chance to listen to a lot of the great old blues musicians here in Europe. And people like Howlin' Wolf, for example, was the first really impression of American music. I always carried that picture with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a kind of dedication to all the great guys, all the American music I've learned so much from, and actually it made my life somehow.
Yeah. I'm curious about the Dixieland thing, because was that something that you had in common with Mangelsdorf? Because he played, you know, the trombone is a big instrument in there, and you two worked together early on. Did you share that at all, or?
Well, yeah, you know, when I was a kid, we had here in Europe the so-called revival time, which was revival of Dixieland, mostly coming from English bands, but the English bands toured all around Western Europe, at least, and it was a big thing, and that's I grew up with. And so I grabbed the clarinet from a guy who left school, the school band, and so the clarinet was free, and I grabbed the clarinet and started to play with my 1-2-3 records I had at home at that time. So I'm still a bloody amateur, but that's the way the whole thing started.
Mm-hmm.
And but the good thing was that I have to find my own way to do my voice and my thing. And I was lucky to find the right guys to work with. American guys, European guys like Derek Bailey or Han Benning or Misha Mengelberg, or very early Steve Lacy or Carla Bley, and Don Cherry, of course, because he was living here in Europe in the early 60s and the 60s anyway. So that was all big influences. And of course, that was a time where you could hear in Europe all the great American bands. I mean, I've heard all of the Miles Davis bands. I have heard all the Coltrane with Adderley, Coltrane with Eric Dolphy, and Mingus with Dolphy, and all that folks. But on the other hand, I've heard the Count Basie or Duke Ellington bands. And so you could get a lot of information in these times. And on the other hand, you know, at that early years, my goal was being a painter. Music was on the side and very, very important. But my goal in this year still was being a painter, and via this being busy with the arts, I met a lot of people from other fields of besides the music, like Joseph Beuys, for example, the famous German painter, or the Korean guy Nam June Paik, or I was working a little bit with guys from the Platters movement.
Mm-hmm.
So I got quite a wide range of information in my head, and what I learned from that it was very clear for me. I have to find, the only thing is to find your own way, your own voice, your own, you have to tell your own shit. As
yeah.
much as I've learned and listened to from other music, but you know, when I grew up in the 60s, it was Karlheinz Stockhausen here opening up his electronic studio in Cologne, and all this, or John Cage was very often in Europe with David Tudor. And this side of the music and information you could get if you wanted. And that was the other side of it, and very important too.
Was can you remember when you kind of discovered your tone on the tenor? Like, how old were you when this sound kind of came to you, and did you know right away that that was the path?
Yeah, let me think. when I played in this Dixieland swing band, the guys of the band were quite a bit older than I was, and one day they came and said, "Man, Gershwin, we need a tenor, we need a saxophone." And so I bought a very old and very shitty saxophone, but somehow it was working. And in this band, everybody had a kind of solo thing as a trio, just with the bass and drums. And I remember my title at that time was I Got Rhythm. And I like to play without all the others, just with bass and drums. And I had my, so I could already get crazy in a way, and didn't have to listen to the others, just play with drums and bass was quite an open thing. And I got my first response from the audience, quite some clapping and screaming. And of course, as a young man, I liked that very much. So I thought, okay, that's a fine thing to do.
Yeah.
So sometimes things are very simple, you know. Mm-hmm. It was like that. And since that, maybe my preference, the trio formation, was always very, very tempting for me, and still is.
Yeah. The title piece for this album, I Surrender Dear, Monk recorded it as a solo piano thing, but Illinois Jacquet recorded it too. Did you have that version in mind when you were doing yours?
I had a lot of versions in mind because I, since years, I always loved that song very much. But the most I liked was Don Byas' version.
Oh, okay.
That is such a beautiful thing. I mean, Hawkins recorded, all the guys recorded, all tenor players recorded it at one time. And of course, I know the Monk version too, and of course it is most beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other song, Lover Come Back to Me, is one that a lot of guys have recorded too. I know Coleman Hawkins, Ben Webster, John Coltrane. Do you have a favorite of that one?
I think this my love to this tune goes back to a Donald Byrd record, a Blue Note with the baritone Pepper Adams.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I like that very much. Yeah, but of course I've heard all kind of different versions of it over the years, and the Billie Holiday version is a beautiful thing. So.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, that the first three songs all blend together. So, I mean, were you trying to sort of suggest that they're all one song in a way? Or did they just bridge really nicely for you, you know?
I mean, I didn't go with a concept or with a list of tunes into the studio. I just was standing in the studio, and I started to play. And after a while, one after the other song just was there. And that's the way it went. Mm-hmm. It was not really, okay, I play now, I play Lover Come Back to Me. It just happened to be there. Or, for example, the song Nice Work If You Can Get It. I never played before in such a kind of situation. It just came into my mind somehow, and I just played in my way.
And is that the same way you were saying that this is kind of what you do when you're practicing at home? So it's the same kind of thing, just kind of going from tune to tune and, you know, just...
Yeah, I'm being at home, I'm mostly busy with the sound, and the best thing you can do is playing some songs, because, they have so much sound quality, and it's good to develop the sound on the horn with them. And I'm standing here at home, and I play whatever comes in my head. So, and it's quite a list of songs. I even don't know the name of the songs, but they are since decades in my brain somehow.
Yeah, I know some other players that I've spoken to, like Sonny Rollins and David Ware, have both said that they, when they're practicing, they don't practice scales or anything. They just kind of play for a couple of hours or something, you know?
Yeah, that would be my way doing things too, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, of course, and if you mention Sonny Rollins, you shouldn't forget him, of course. He always... was such an amazing guy. I've seen him here in Europe a lot of times in the early years, and the last time I saw him, now it's not so long ago, maybe 5 years ago, at a Norwegian festival, being on stage, still playing great, but his body was already quite a bit damaged.
Mm.
But he was playing great, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The piece Dark Blues is on this record, and you've played that on a couple other of your albums that I know of. Do you compose a lot of tunes, or just, you know, here, like, have themes here and there?
I wouldn't call it composing. I mean, they just happen to be there one night, and then, of course... if you like it, you keep it in your brain and use it from time to time. And I think it's very, very good thing to come back to the blues from time to time, just to make sure where you are.
Tell me about the visual side of this, the cover art. How big is it in real life, and how was it made? Like, what medium did you use?
I was working on the cover. You know, my way of working on it, trying this, trying that, and the first tries I threw away. They went to the paper basket. And... I had this, it's a kind of 2 meters square canvas was in my studio there, and it had already the background. So I, for one reason, I started, man, why not? I just tried something, and at the end, I think, yeah, it ended up to be quite a nice cover.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, quite fitting to the music too.
Is it like an oil painting or mixed media? You know, what did you use?
It's a kind of mixed media thing. It's oil and ink and all kind of shit. Yeah.
Yeah, and where did the photograph come from?
Yeah, that is, of course, a very little special thing. You know, nowadays, the young people can they can get any kind of pornography or whatever. But, you know, the time I grew up, pictures of naked women, I'm talking about the 50s, were very rare, and for some reason I found this, I think it's a French French piece of paper. I found this photograph, and I kept it through all the years. So I thought that's the right moment to use it for something.
Do you do that a lot? Do you stockpile stuff and think, you know, I'll need this someday for a painting or, you know, for something?
That's a part of working with my visual things, yeah. You find fabrics or other kind of materials or a piece of paper with some letters on or so. If it looks interesting enough, I keep it, and there might be a time it can get useful for something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always, from my very first art things, I always was trying to use a lot of usually not used materials and fabrics for like collage technique and things like that. I always liked that, and I still do.
Do you spend a lot of
I do my watercolors and my ink things and the usual oil stuff too, but I'm always was and still am interested in fabrics and things, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Do you work on visual art a lot these days?
Nah, I should do more. It's a question of time. Being on the road, it takes so much time and it takes so much energy too. And quite a bit older, you need a bit more time than usual to recover. So I just can't get home from a tour and go into my studio. It needs a bit more time. And you know, for the gigs nowadays, you have to travel so far, and travel is you spend all the time for that. And so I could use more time for at home, being at home.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be a good thing, but it's the way the jobs are coming in. Yeah, I like that. You have to go.
Do you, because you have some people that you work with steadily, like, you know, Mats Gustafsson and Paul Nissenlove and, you know, the guys from Full Blast and things like that, but do you get a lot of invitations from other people to say, you know, like some band somewhere is like, hey, come play with us, you know, and stuff like that?
That happens quite a lot, and I'm open to everything. I mean, for example, I'm working since 5 years now with Heather Lee, and she was asking me, so I said yes. I had no idea what she was doing, but we found out at the first moment, okay, it's something happening, and I'm always open that... I'm careful too, on the other hand. I mean, there are a lot of bands just asking you because you have a kind of name and they think it's useful. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested of making music. I work with a Portuguese rock and roll band, more or less. And I like the guys, and I was working last year, or is it 1 year, 2 years ago, with some guys from California, the Oxbow people. Maybe you know the name.
Yeah, I know Eugene from Oxbow, yeah.
Yeah, Eugene is a great guy, I think. I enjoyed that very much, and I hope we can do it again. But I'm careful. On the other hand, I'm always looking around for new sounds, new players, and it's really hard because most of them, 99%, they come out of the conservatories, and they have learned the same, they sound the same, but sometimes you find a unique voice somewhere, and that's always a good surprise.
Do you connect better with someone if you feel like they have some knowledge of history and tradition, like what you were talking about, or can you just sort of dive in if somebody's doing something interesting, even if it's from a totally different background?
That's not necessary. I mean, I'm going quite often to Japan, for example, and over the years I played there with a couple of traditional Japanese players, and they had no ideas what I was doing, no ideas about jazz music. It's just about getting a feeling for the other voice, and I think what you have to learn and what you, the best school is being on the road. Your eyes are open for everything, and if there is somebody who can tell you something, that's okay. It doesn't have to be a guy who is coming out of the jazz tradition. That's not necessary.
Yeah, it's the record that you made recently with Sato and Toyozumi, I think it was. It was interesting because I read a book about Japanese free jazz, and they were talking about how important it was for them to come up with something that represented their Japanese-ness in the context of free music.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Japanese, they are special. They are very special. That's why I like them so much, or at least some of them. And I during the last decades, I was working with a lot of older and younger Japanese people, and most of them, they have their own way of playing, of talking. They are still aware about their not just being Japanese. And it's a special. I'm traveling through all the Asian world. I have been in China. I've met musicians there. They're completely different. Japanese are really a very unique species. I just had some days at the Cafe Otto in London. And I could invite some of my old Japanese friends, like Sato and the drummer Murayama. And it's always very, very special to play with them. And it's, for me, it's always a pleasure. Yeah. I work a lot with Keiji Aino, who really comes from the other side of music, but we developed over the years. We developed quite a good understanding, and that's the main important thing.
This would you ever make an album of tunes like this with a band, like let's say with William and Hamid, or something like that? Or is this kind of music something you prefer to do just solo for yourself?
Yeah, that is an interesting question. Of course, over the years, I always was thinking, should I do it with a band, with drums and bass? And of course, Hamid and William would be, I think, the best choice, or another other two guys I like very much is Nasheed Wade and Eric Revis. That would be another interesting thing. Maybe next case. Maybe we could try.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be a possibility.
Yeah. I guess my last question is, because Ginger Baker recently passed, you and Sonny Chirac played with him once in like 87. What was your impression of him as a person and as a collaborator musically?
It was quite a mixed band because we wanted another bass player, and the whole situation was not so perfect. And when we had the first meeting, a kind of rehearsal, Ginger looked at me, what is this guy doing there? He couldn't believe it. And it was in the beginning not such a real friendly feeling, but then we were sitting down at a table and killed a couple of bottles of scotch, I think it was, and after that it was working very well, and he was a good comrade. He had his own way of life, and very special guy, but working wise, I like to remember that days. Yeah. At the end, we came to quite a good understanding.
Mm-hmm. He had a really interesting rhythmic sense. You know, he had an idea of what he wanted behind the kit, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had his very special way of doing it. But you know, I'm always, drummers have been, through my little career, have been always the most interesting people for me. That means I have played from Benning to Andrew Cyril to Milford Graves to my old friend, Walter Perkins, who really came from another world, but a lot of all the European good drummers, I would say Shane Jackson and Ginger Baker, they had the most very personal and very special way of doing it. And that's why I liked Shane Jackson so much. Very, very special guy too. And Ginger had, of course, his background was something heavy. He didn't know very special things.
All right. That was my interview with Peter Breutzmann, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. We'll be back in a month or so, so thanks again for your time and attention. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll come back for the next one. Osiris.